Listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show is going to be a number of interesting topics associated with how you can prevent yourself from being scammed, like identity theft and getting your credit card number stolen and problems like that, as well as some server updates and interesting medical updates associated with 5G wireless. So let's get started. I'm going to post a bunch of these articles to the associated page that associates this show, and then you can go into more detail there and check them out, because in this case, I think you actually want to see some pictures. But let's first get started with this whole question of how do you avoid a credit card skimmer at the gas station pump, which tends to be predominantly the biggest area where credit card numbers or debit card numbers and their associated PIN numbers are getting stolen. And there was a very interesting study being done by the San Antonio Police Department, and what they were finding, they were trying to create this correlation and understand what was really the causation of these credit card skimming thefts and debit card skimming thefts. And what they found out was that the delineation between whether or not your credit and debit card was going to get stolen at a gas pump was really based upon the type of pump that it was. Now, of course, that's not terribly surprising, right? But let's articulate what those differences are. So there's these older models of fuel pumps that are flat in terms of the keypads, and they call these a membrane-based keypad. And then they have a vertical card reader. And these, again, photographs of this are going to be available on this article that I post with the show. And what they found was that these older fuel pumps, in most cases, they did not have the tamper detection capabilities that newer fuel pumps have. They don't have the security features in terms of effectively making it significantly more difficult for someone to not only get into the fuel pump to open it up to get at the guts inside, but then just simply put a skimmer on that keypad. Because you know that there are certain protections built into credit cards and debit cards, such as, okay, you've swiped your card and now it wants to know your zip code. Well, certainly if the bad guys have put technology in between the front face of that fuel pump station that you're interacting with and the guts behind it, so they're effectively intercepting all of those communications. This includes the keypad. So that means that they would have that data, which is the zip code and the PIN number and these sorts of things. So the tamper-resistant fuel pumps, when you visibly look at them, what they look like is they have raised metallic numbers on the keypad. And the industry, the fuel pump industry, calls these full travel keypads. And then they tend to have horizontal card readers, and the locks are custom for every single fuel pump, as opposed to the locks for these older style fuel pumps were just generic, meaning that if somebody managed to get their hands on a key that would open one of those fuel pumps, then it would work at every fuel pump that had that kind of a model out there. And boy, you may think, well, that was a stupid idea from the beginning by the manufacturer. And I would absolutely agree. But, you know, it fundamentally comes down to something that I've learned after 25 years in this industry, which is that by and large, I'm not going to say 100% of the case, but by and large, most of the time, companies, manufacturers do not implement security practices unless their customers demand it. And that is very disappointing. It's very, very disappointing. But that's the reality of it. So, you know, at this point, what I'm trying to do is make sure that you know not to put your credit card number or your credit card or your debit card into a fuel depot station where it does not have the raised metallic full travel number pad. Because that's the easiest way for you to determine whether it's a new fuel pump station or an old style fuel pump station. And it's dramatic. It's like there's almost no credit or debit card thefts that are occurring at these newer fuel pump stations versus the old fuel pump stations. It was just ridiculous. It was like more than 90% of the credit and card and debit card thefts that were occurring associated with fuel pump stations in general were all coming from these old style fuel pumps. So just avoid those things. Now, there was another this really interesting article that I think is a topic we haven't talked about for a while, but have talked about before. It's this concept of planting your flag and marking your territory. Now, some years ago, I brought up the point about the Social Security website. And of course, every U.S. citizen and even some non-citizens have Social Security numbers. And if you do not have a corresponding SSA.gov website login ID and password, so you haven't created that account, then the problem that can happen is someone else who has managed to obtain enough information about you can go out there and sign up for an account. Therefore, then now the bad guys have got an account that's tied to, say, their cell phone number. And that would be really problematic. So this concept really comes down to the dangers of not being proactive about creating online accounts with the organizations where you should have accounts with. So if you have a bank or credit card or something like that, where it's obviously something financial, and maybe you wish to continue to receive paper statements and to interact with that entity in a non-online fashion. The point here is that that doesn't mean that that precludes you from needing to plant your flag, meaning you need to go out there and actually create that online account and sign up for the online account and then keep track of that online account information. Because if you don't, then the bad guys can create an account and end up hijacking your life. And this particular article was very interesting because it was talking about an older gentleman who just went through a whole a litany of problems simply because he did not have online accounts with his bank, with his mobile phone carrier, and even his ISP. And so what had happened was the bad guys got a hold of his identity and then was able to basically take over and hijack pretty much the rest of his life because they could go to the mobile phone carrier and create an online account and go ahead and do a bunch of other things that was effectively now they're stealing his online identity as well because he did not prior plant his flag. And what I mean by planting your flag is go out there and create an account for yourself, with your ISP, with your mobile phone carrier, with your bank, etc., obviously with SSA.gov. And then that way, that account has been created. You've selected the username, you've selected the password, you've tied it to your mobile phone number, and these sorts of things, which means that it makes it much more difficult for the bad guys to go in and just simply create an account and specify in there whatever the heck they want, and thereby being able to jack up your life even further. And this is really, really super important because these online accounts have now become an extension of the way that these organizations validate that you are authorized for that service. So they, I mean, you'd have to kind of think about this from their perspective and say, how is it that they would know that you are who you say you are? They don't see you. You're talking to them over the telephone. And, you know, how are they supposed to know? So they're going to then be validating you against the information that they have on file. Well, if you're not the one who created the account, then all the information that they have on file is going to be different from the information that you know. And then you're going to look like the fraudster, even though it's really your identity. So we've gotten to the point now in society where, sure, you can decide I'm not going to do these things online, but this also means you still have to actually go out there and create the account, because otherwise it can get very, very bad, because somebody can steal your identity and then steal control over all of your services, your phone number, your credit, debit cards, accounts that you have with various vendors, your ISP, etc. And then that can just really make everything really get out of hand. All right, let's talk about another topic, which has to do with location data sharing, which is a huge hot button in terms of not only privacy issues, but also Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. So I think you all are aware that cell phones that have a GPS enabled, and even in the circumstance that they don't have the GPS enabled, it's still a matter of cell tower triangulation data gives relatively fairly accurate location data as to where you are. And this location information is being collected in a continual stream between your cell phone and the cell phone carrier. Well, this was for a very, very long time, this data has been collected, and then it was supposed to be getting aggregated, and AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, Verizon, etc., all of these organizations were engaging in third-party customer location data sharing agreements. And this is where it all went sideways. Well, there was a PhD student at Carnegie Mellon University who did some very interesting research where what he discovered was that through these agreements with these third parties, data from all of the cell phone carriers was literally, and I'm talking precise, real time. This is where it's really disturbing here. It's precise, real time location data on a specific phone number, meaning if somebody knew what your cell phone number was and they wanted to stalk you, they could have actually for free, publicly, and in anonymous access obtained this data. And this was not restricted to United States access. It certainly was not restricted to law enforcement, although, you know, I mean, that's up for debate as to whether that data should be available without a warrant anyhow. So what ended up happening was that this was a really, really big brouhaha, because this location data sharing was clearly in violation of the original location data sharing agreements that multiple carriers had with these companies. And It was quite the expose on the fact that these third party agreements are just total bull. And so the cell phone carriers, the phone providers, they had these arrangements with these location aggregators that contractually said things like, you agree to not use this data we provide you without getting customer consent. And then this aggregator, this location data aggregator, would make another agreement with another company to share that data, and so forth and so forth. And what ended up happening was there's huge chain of trust where it was one location aggregator is sharing data with another who's sharing it with another downstream, and they're all downstreaming all of this data. And there was nowhere in this chain of trust that any phone user had actually consented to the sharing of their location data with, you know, 20 location data carriers or providers. And then, of course, the cell phone carriers, they would have no visibility into how this data was actually being shared out. So it got really, really, really out of hand. And Verizon was the first company that said, and I say first meaning from a time perspective here in this incident when this information became available, that they basically said, they contacted the location aggregators and said, we're done. You guys will not have access to our customers' location data, and we're cutting you off. So that was great. AT&T initially did not block that access. They eventually came around and said, we will start to terminate sharing agreements with regards to sharing customer location data with third parties. So I think the big takeaway for this whole incident here was, yet again, it was an individual. It was a white hat security expert doing their own independent investigation, following the rabbit trail of what can you gain access to, where is it coming from, piecing those parts of the puzzle together. So it's really disgusting that we're looking at all of the corporate resources of Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, all of these carriers provide combined. Not a single one of these massive companies appears to have one person in their full-time employ whose job is to audit how data that they are sharing with third parties is being utilized. And I find that disturbing. If I was part of the FCC, I think I would be looking into that and making recommendations to Congress, telling them that, you know, look, if you're a carrier and you're raking in more than $20 million in revenue every year, then you should be able to afford to have a full-time auditor whose job is to investigate how it is that data that the carrier is sharing with anyone, including the government, is being utilized. You know, there's a huge need for corporations to have internal auditors to keep track of this stuff and to do their own investigations. All right, let's talk very quickly about a new product called a Dell System Update for PowerEdge servers. This is just for PowerEdge servers. If you have a Dell computer, there's a product called Dell Command Update, which is a fantastic little utility. All you need to do is run that as an administrator, and then it will check for firmware updates and software drivers for your computer, which is really, really, really important to do because those sorts of things are not going to come with Windows updates or any other software updates. And this is true if you had another brand of computer as well. You should be looking for the firmware update utility that's associated with your system and using it. And I would say it's not going to hurt you to check once a month. At the very least, you should be doing it about 6 times a year, so every other month. So with regards to updating servers, this can be a little bit more challenging because it's significantly more complicated. Now, I'm going to talk about Dell servers here simply because I think they're the best and the industry speaks volumes to that. Dell is the top-selling servers worldwide, and there's a reason for that. They certainly innovate in terms of not only reliability and stability, but also their warranty plans are the best. And they've just increased their capabilities for making systems management of these PowerEdge servers, as well as updating them, easier. So just like on your PCs where there are firmware updates and driver updates for that firmware, like a RAID controller or a motherboard or BIOS, these sorts of things, these same things exist on a server. So just like the firmware updates that your PC needs, your server needs these as well. And they need them pretty much as frequently as well. I would say 6 times a year, you should be checking for these updates for your servers. So historically, there was a product called the Lifecycle Controller, which required you to, and that still exists, but it required you to shut down your server and then go into this other utility, which is very easy to use, but it was a way for the server to be shut down all the way and to be offline, and then for updates to be inventoried to see which updates are necessary and then to install those updates. So the Lifecycle Controller is still a very, very, very good utility, and it's a preferred method for installing those updates. The one downside that it has is that, of course, your server is offline in the process, and that can be less than desirable. So what do you do in the case where maybe you just want to check as to what the updates are that are necessary for your system? And that is one of the big strong suits for Dell System Update for PowerEdge servers. If you download and install DSU and then run it, there's a little inventory phase. You run it with an inventory phase where it then interrogates what's installed on the server compared to the current catalog of updates that's available. And then it will show you what updates your server needs. So this is really great because this is all able to be done while the server is up and running. So you can just proactively check, what updates are necessary. And if you find that some updates are necessary, you can actually install them through Dell System Update. There are certain updates that are not going to install effectively through that approach, but a lot of them will. So like all of these server update utilities that exist, because there's other methods other than these just two that I've described here, you want to be able to know how to use all of these different techniques to get things updated and to keep them updated. Because certain updates will only install via one method. So it's important to know how to use all of them. But the big deal with Dell System Update here is its great advantages here in terms of being able to do this up-to-date, very, very effective inventory and telling you exactly what it is that needs to be installed on the server without having to take it down. So I definitely encourage you, if you have a PowerEdge server, go out there and get that downloaded, and certainly make sure that you also have Open Managed Server Administrator installed. I just looked at somebody's server yesterday, a server that I don't manage, and I found that they did not have Open Managed Server Administrator installed, and the server was encountering a hardware problem. And the only reason that that was actually recognized is because I looked at the server and I noticed that it had an orange flashing light warning going on it. So that means that you know, if I would not have been standing in front of that server looking at it and be aware of certain things like that, then that hardware problem would just go on and on and on and unrecognized. This also brings up the point as to why it's critical that you do have server monitoring. The way it's supposed to work, and really the only way that the system works really effectively, is first and foremost, you have to have a product like OpenManage Server Administrator, which is also free, installed on the Dell PowerEdge server. What this does is it interacts with the hardware, and it says, you know, how are you healthy? What are your versions? What's your status? These sorts of things. And then it reports that to the operating system and specifically to the various event logs on the server. You then have to have a monitoring tool that you're utilizing in order to look for certain classification of events that exist on that server and then report them back to you. So Kaseya, as an example, has a really good system. When you program it effectively, it will look at those event logs and it will email notify the appropriate people that you've configured to be notified as to the problems. And recently, I'd say in the last 3 months, I've seen two servers that were having a CPU temperature overload. And so the fact that that monitoring was in place made it so that we knew about these issues proactively before the, you know, before the server overheated big time and decided it was going to shut down and just go offline. Without the monitoring, we would have never actually known about it. And part of that monitoring is you actually have to have OpenManage Server Administrator installed. And I am disheartened by how many times I see unqualified people managing Dell servers, not doing basic standard things such as installing OpenManage Server Administrator so that they can know what is going on with the hardware of that server. I mean, these applications are free. There's no reason to avoid installing them. Gentleman that I was talking to yesterday was talking about how these apps take up space and whatever. And it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous, specious argument, really. The installer is like 200 megabytes. It's, you know, even if it was 1 gigabyte, I don't care, because the reality is if you don't have that utility installed, you have no idea what is going on with the hardware of that server. And if there's a failed hard drive, if the CPU is overloading, if there's a battery that's dying, I mean, whatever the hardware failure is, you have no idea that it's going on. And the whole point of this software is to proactively know what's going on so that you can deal with it before it becomes a critical server down issue. All right, well, on the next show, I want to go into the details of 5G cellular radiation and what it means medically, because this actually turns out to be an extremely big deal. There are certainly people that are saying, oh, poo-poo, there are no problems, but yet people like the National Toxicology Program went and invested $25 million into a study where they studied the nature of EMF radiation, and their entire purpose in the study was to prove that mobile phone radiation was safe. And what they ended up finding in their investigation was that even old, ancient technologies such as 2G, which is very weak in comparison to 5G cellular radiation, even primitive technologies like 2G can damage DNA and it can cause brain cancer. Therefore, the only logical conclusion to come to is that stronger 5G radiation emitted from more towers will be exponentially more damaging. Well, we'll talk about that on the next show.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
Support comes from the Bristol Renaissance Fair. Eat, drink, and be merry. Suck